in the text that we've been examining, the Ocean of Definitive Meaning, in the Vipassana section, there are three ways of really approaching meditations on seeking the nature of the mind. So the first of these is what we looked at yesterday, which is looking at the nature of the mind in stillness. So first of all, that begins with shamatha, and you then rest your mind in the stillness of shamatha, and then you examine the nature of the mind that is still, and you look for substantial characteristics and qualities, and you know, you either find some or you don't. and you approach the nature of the mind, then you discover its empty nature, in that is an absence of substantial characteristics. So it is insubstantial. And this is just something that you come to. You have looked at every possibility, really, of substantial characteristics for, you know, shape, size, location, origin, destination, presence, etc. And that when you're just left with nothing, that is the experience of the nature of the mind in stillness. But of course, you don't find an absolute nothingness either. And so what you are left with then is this paradox, I guess, which there is something, you can't say that the mind is in stillness, is something that exists with substantial, because you can't find any substantial characteristics that would indicate that it exists. But on the other hand, you can't say it doesn't exist either, because obviously there is a mind that is doing the meditation and is coming to the conclusion. And so you basically realize that the whole premise of what you have been looking for is somehow flawed from the beginning, and that you realize that this thing that is so intimate, this experience of ours, the mind, what we take to be so real and so substantial and really the essence of me, who I am, that you just can't point to it as being a thing. And so it is something in this paradoxical way that is beyond existence, but it is beyond non-existence also. So the way that the conceptual mind would like to know the mind just does not compute when you get to understanding the essence of the mind, or when you try to fathom the essence of the mind. It just blows up, because it's inappropriate. It is a, you're trying to apply a tool to find a solution that just, it is not suitable for. So that's the first one that we did, looking at the mind in stillness. And then the key to that, the way that this is described, is looking at the mind in stillness. So it really relies on this direct observation. And rather than, because what we are trying to do is, because the Mahasiddha masters recognized right away that because the conceptual mind just is incapable of knowing the nature of the mind, that you can't try to analyze your way to the nature of the mind. You can't try to, inferential reasoning is going to find its limit very quickly. And you are going to be stuck with that basic fact that the conceptual mind believes that it is the only thing that exists. So it's going to become very quickly satisfied with its answer. And you are going to be stuck basically knowing the right answer, but without any transformative power at all. So your perceptions aren't going to change simply because you know the right answer. And this is what we need, you know, as practitioners, what we are hoping for is the transformation. So not only that, you know, eventually, not only do we know that things are illusory, but they no longer are even appearing that way. We are seeing them in the moment that they arise, these appearances, as luminous displays of mind itself. And that's just the way that they appear to us. So, you know, that is the horizon that we are moving towards. So the next way then of, in the Vipassana practices, of the three, and the one that we are going to explore this morning, is looking at the mind in movement. So we, yesterday, stillness, today, movement. Or it is also, other translators of Trungpa Rinpoche have used the term occurrence, which is interesting also. So it is, occurrence means that there is something occurring, something is happening. In stillness, nothing is happening. There is an, you know, it's still, it's the mirror-like smoothness, but there's movement now, which is producing occurrence, and what it's producing is occurrence of thought or mental activity. And then the third investigation in this text is looking at the mind in appearance. And that's one that we're not going to do today. And as I mentioned, they all three lead to the same conclusion. And again, Trungpa Rinpoche said that just as with the shamatha practices, you might find that you resonate more with one of these approaches rather than the other. And so you would really naturally focus on what you resonate with and take that, but they all are going to lead you to the same real transformation, the same transformative realization. And the one about appearances, as somebody pointed out, it's very similar to looking at the mind in movement, because one of the things that we're looking at is thought in the mind of movement. But appearances takes a little different approach. It's just different technique. And this is where we find what is so dear to me, the four different approaches that we've used in some of my retreats in the past, almost every retreat of the past couple years anyway, end up looking at mind is, so all appearances are mind. Mind is empty. Emptiness is spontaneous actualization. Spontaneous actualization is self-liberation. So it specifically looks, you know, takes that approach, which is a very elegant and comprehensive also. I mean, that one, it just seems like, wow, if you do that, what more do you need? But what you certainly realize after you've been through, gotten the whole menu of the mind in stillness, and you've gone through the mind in stillness, mind in movement, and then you get to appearances, and you get to the point of mind is emptiness. Well, it's, yeah, I've proven that to myself already. So, you know, the work is really done. And basically the way that you would go about that in that approach would be basically to, you know, reprise all of the techniques that you did before. And when I have taught that before, because I didn't quite have the knowledge or experience that I have even at this point of that, then I was having to rely on some of the other presentations that I've heard of emptiness of mind. And of course, those are very largely conceptual, analytical approaches, Majjhimaka. And so, you know, next approach will be a little more different because it will be looking at, you know, directly. And then we all know now what the big difference is in that. So, and the reason that Mahamudra looks at both the mind in stillness and in movement is that we naturally think of the mind in stillness and movement as very different. Because in the mind in stillness, there are no appearances, no conceptuality. And the mind in movement can be full of conceptuality, full of thought. So how could these, so naturally we think of these, because they are different in appearance, we think of them that they must be different. And when we think of them that they must be different, what the word that we're not stating is that they must be different in nature, different in essence. And simply because they appear differently, that they manifest themselves differently, then what we're going to investigate is, does that mean that the mind actually, when it's in stillness, and the mind when it's in movement, are they actually two separate minds? Or is it one mind with one nature? So that, I mean, that's a powerful distinction. Powerful distinction. And we can go down some blind alleys, I think, if we don't really understand this. So Trungpa Rinpoche points out that basically, you know, we're looking at, you could say, the relative nature of mind and the ultimate nature of mind as well. So basically manifest and essential nature of the mind, you know, how do they appear, and then what is their essence? And so he points out that the confused mind that is entranced by the relative appearances, so the deluded mind that actually believes in the reality of external appearances, that they are independent and totally separate from the mind, that is naturally going to see the mind in movement and the mind in stillness as two different minds. And it will likely then come to prefer one of these minds over the other and try to eliminate one of the minds and just cultivate only one mind. And one mind is a problem and one mind is a goal. So that sounds kind of familiar, doesn't it? I see smiles on some of your faces. So is this the approach? Have we been meditating with a confused mind, maybe? And the unconfused mind is going to really begin to fathom that this is one mind that we're dealing with here. One mind, and then is there, you know, sometimes we might even think when we're meditating that there must be at least three minds. You know, there's the mind in movement. There's the mind that I don't want. There's the mind in stillness that I do want. And then there's got to be at least another mind that is observing the mind in stillness and preferring it. You know, so isn't that kind of the way that it can feel? And then it gets really confusing. So we really have to get clear about how many minds are there that we're dealing with here. And that simplifies things quite a lot. And then just to give away the punchline, what we find then when we are meditating with an unconfused mind, that the mind in movement so is manifesting as thoughts, but this is mind. The thoughts are mind in movement. It's not as if thoughts are something different than mind. It's just mind in movement is manifesting as the mind is moving, and it is manifesting as these appearances of thought. And so we are first of all looking at, we are going to approach, first of all, and discover the What did we observe? Almost said conclude. What did we observe when we were looking at the nature of the mind in stillness? Well, that we couldn't find, you know, and if you didn't find it, that's okay, because you want to be truthful about what you're observing and not superimpose your conceptual knowledge on it. But, you know, at some point, you'll directly observe that you can't find any substantial characteristics. And what you're left with then is that this mind in stillness is insubstantial. So that's its emptiness, the absence of substantial characteristics, but that it is luminous. So you can't find existence, but it's not non-existent. So it is this luminosity hyphen emptiness that Yangtang Rinpoche led us to yesterday afternoon. The essential nature and the manifest nature being this non-dual experience and non-dual nature of mind, of pristine awareness. And here, you know, because earlier I'd said mind, Mahamudra usually thinks of mind in what other people might say is mind with a small m. And then if you say mind with a big M, capital M, you know, it's all the totality of possibilities, including Rigpa, etc. But then I don't think that he used the term mind there. Alan translated as pristine awareness, you know, so the non-duality, non-dual characteristics of pristine awareness, not mind, are this non-dual luminosity and emptiness. Or Trangu Rinpoche says non-dual lucidity cognizance, so slash lucidity cognizance, hyphen, lucidity hyphen cognizance. So that is, the knowing luminous quality and then hyphen emptiness. So you get to basically, so the lucidity cognizance, we can just combine that into luminosity and then emptiness. So, you know, the non-dual luminosity emptiness. And there you have then the manifest and essential natures of pristine awareness. So what you discover is that the mind, whether the mind is in movement or whether the mind is still, is that. It has the same nature. And so we're going to approach that then by first of all looking at thoughts, which are, you could say, the waves on the water, and then say, what is the nature of these thoughts? And then the thoughts are, at first, may seem to be produced by mind, you know, like a widget. You know, so the mind is the machine that is stamping out thoughts. And then, you know, you package these donuts and distribute them and then, you know, bank the profits. You know, so it can seem like, and if that's the case, then thoughts and mind would be really quite different in their nature. But we're going to, first of all, approach we know that the mind in stillness is empty. And we're going to approach trying to see whether there's a difference between the nature of the mind in stillness and movement by looking at the widgets, and then realize that these are not widgets, that this is mind that we're looking at. But it is simply the mind in movement that is appearing as thoughts. And we'll see that, and basically we're going to ask the same questions that we asked of the mind in stillness. And then we'll see whether we come up, we observe the same thing. And then we'll see whether we can recognize that these are not widgets, this thought. It is mind in movement. And then recognize that it's all luminosity emptiness. So, If we think that there are two minds that are different in nature, then we will definitely prefer, as shamatha practitioners, we will prefer the mind that in stillness, and then we will try to recycle, send to China, our mind in movement, get rid of it, you know, do something with it. But because we would prefer the mind in stillness. And so here's what the great Gampopa had to say about that. If you know how to rest within whatever thought arises, and it is therefore self-liberated, then, since that itself is the Dharmakaya, they are indeed worthy of being cherished. So if you can really see, if you're resting in thought as it arises, you recognize that these are the displays of Dharmakaya, and they are nothing other than Dharmakaya. And so because these thoughts then are Dharmakaya, then these thoughts are worthy of being cherished as you would cherish Dharmakaya. If you do not have this attitude, if you do not regard thoughts as opportunities for insight, meditation becomes very difficult and inconvenient because it becomes a battle against thinking, which, among other things, makes the meditation unclear and unstable. So, boy, wouldn't that make it easier if we didn't have to battle thinking? If the mind in movement was not something that was a problem, but actually that every thought, every movement of mind provided an opportunity to recognize the nature of mind itself. So at this point, I'd like to take a commercial break, short interruption, for a campaign announcement about how to make America great. Since time is short and you're my captive audience, and this message has been approved, I'd like to return to the question last night about how to make America great. And so is one of the reasons America is not great right now, so I'm really reading a lot into this right now, because of my attachment, you know, not mine. So this is the website thing again also. Not mine, but the questioner's attachment to the form of the opposite sex, right? So the question was basically, how do I overcome my attachment to the form of the opposite sex? So my answer was really very, I think, pretty superficial and not very satisfying. And I knew that there was something buzzing, orbiting around it, and it was just eluding me. I couldn't, you know, and so I basically ended up saying nothing because there was something there that I just couldn't get or wasn't coming in. And it was late and it was just, oh, well. But I think if you, what I realized after my mind cleared a little bit was that if you were to substitute the word craving rather than attachment for the craving for the form of the opposite sex rather than attachment. So often this mental affliction is craving / attachment because they're the same, But they're different in the sense that usually craving refers to something that you don't have and that you want. Attachment refers to something that you have and you don't want to lose. But the issue is that you see them both in a deluded way, that you see them as the cause of your happiness. And so that you need this external thing to be happy. And so if that's the case, then, you know, and I think that we go through this craving experience, you know, it's maybe when we're young, more young, and we don't have a relationship, for instance, and, you know, you're just shopping around, or you have one and you're shopping around. But, you know, it's something that you don't have and you're craving it. And the reason that and then if you have the relationship and you're finding value in it or whatever, or you see it as the cause of your happiness, then you cling to that with attachment because there's a tremendous threat in losing it because you'll lose your happiness with that as well. So here is the, so it's interesting to look at the craving aspect of it, because craving is such a universal experience for us, especially in this consumer economy, where it is just constantly stimulated. And when we are constantly looking for happiness outside ourselves, we end up with drug dependencies, shopping dependencies, etc. And so is there to make America great again, and that's crazy because, yeah, but for America to realize the potential that it has, you know, and has never come close to, I don't think, realizing that, could this be a real essential point? What is it that we are craving when we are craving whatever it is that we think is going to be a cause of my happiness? And here is Alan's hypothesis about that just resonates so much with me. He says, basically, all of the sense pleasures, when we are pursuing pleasure, hedonic pleasure, what we are really after is non-conceptuality, luminosity, or bliss. And we mistake those as being in things outside of us. So when you think about it, for instance, people who are, you know, extreme sports junkies or race car drivers or people who go fast or people who are taking particular drugs that, like cocaine or methamphetamines or something, that are powerful stimulants. What is it that they are after when they're doing that? Clarity, right? They're just that. And people who are addicted to rage and anger also, there is a real powerful clarity in that. What about then with opioids or, I think, probably alcohol too? Well, maybe not. Let's just say opioids anyway. What about non-conceptuality? You know, just peace, serenity, tranquility. And then let's just say the other one then, craving for sex. What is it that we're after with the craving for sex? Well, bliss. So basically everything, non-conceptuality, luminosity, and bliss, we have an intuition of how satisfying these things are, but we are so mistaken in our belief that these things are commodities that we can consume, and that when we consume them, that we'll get the non-conceptuality, luminosity, and bliss. And then this is the startling hypothesis of Dzogchen and Mahamudra, and that is that genuine happiness is a process of subtraction, not addition. And so you don't have to add all of the things that, like the craving for sex, the craving for stimulation, the craving for peace. You don't have to consume those things, because what you do, you know, and do more to get them, but do less. And you just strip away one thing after another, one obscuration after another, until you find the natural non-conceptuality, luminosity, and bliss that is right there at the core of your mind right now. And even you could say the relative core in substrate consciousness that you can achieve with just shamatha. So that is the promise. And so that, I think, will make America truly great if we can do that. So that, I just wanted to return to that question because I was feeling so embarrassed about my answer. but also because the rest of this class is really the answer to that question then. So what do you do when, because you recognize now that happiness is a process of subtraction and that the non-conceptuality, luminosity, and bliss is there waiting to be discovered, what is it then, what approach do you take when craving arises? So this was the question. How do I get rid of this craving for the form of the opposite sex? Because I think the natural experience is that this is disturbing. This is disturbing, and it's not satisfying. And it's, you know, this is I don't want to live like this constantly with this craving for the opposite sex or for the form of the opposite sex, and seeing that as my happiness. So how do you do that? And I mentioned the way of the monks that is mentioned in the Pali Canon, where basically you feel what you're trying to do is replace the craving with revulsion. So, yeah, I think that probably would work. But so the rest of this class is an alternative to that, is how you can basically recognize that the thought that arises in the present moment, regardless if it's a mental affliction of craving, hostility, attachment, anger, that these are nothing more than the displays of pure mind. They are all one taste, samsara, nirvana. And so when you are able to rest and craving arises or attachment arises, and you do exactly what Gampopa was saying to do here, you rest within the thought and you just watch it without identifying with it, because the appearance is never the problem. You just watch it. You're present with it without identifying it with it, without rejecting it, without pushing it away, without saying, oh, I don't want to be that. This is not me. I'm so sick of that being me. Instead of doing that, you just watch it and you recognize that when you're able to do that, they have a built-in life expectancy. They naturally self-liberate, they self-release, they dissolve back into the space of the mind from which they arose. And what you recognize is that the craving is not a mental affliction inherently. The experience, the appearance of craving in your mind is not necessarily a mental affliction. And that there is something that is necessary, because what happens is that the craving, when you are just watching it, it has the nature, you could say the relative nature, of bliss. And if you just watch and you're just present with that, then you get you can just experience the bliss of the substrate consciousness, basically. And then if you were resting in Rigpa, for instance, then, and the, let's say, attachment then arose, or what we would call attachment, a thought of attachment arose in the mind of someone who was resting in Rigpa, the nature of that is said that it would be the primordial consciousness of wisdom, of discerning wisdom, of discernment. So all of these mental afflictions are related to the three, luminosity, non-conceptuality, and bliss of substrate, and the five primordial wisdoms as well, or the five facets of primordial consciousness, as Lama Allen said. So they, if you are able to just rest with craving, then, for instance, then rather than turn craving into revulsion, see that it just has no essence, whatever. And that, so that is basically, the rest of this class is really the much better answer to that question of from last night. So we return to our regularly scheduled program now. So we begin the practice of looking at the mind in movement by cultivating a state of shamatha. So we're resting in stillness, and then thoughts are very likely to arise while you're resting in this mind of stillness. And then now, at this point, you now take thought as your focal support. And so we're taking an interest in these thoughts, or we're not, as in with breath meditation, if thoughts arise, we know that these are not our object and we would prefer them not to be there. But here we have no preference about their being there or not being there. So thoughts now arise to this mind of stillness, and then we use these as a focal support. And then to do this practice, when the thought arises, we simply look at it, observe it directly, and first of all, just see what we see. And we can ask some questions. And the questions that we ask are going to be the very same questions that we asked about the mind and stillness. Basically, what we're trying to find is, does this mind in movement, which is being, becomes known to us, the mind in movement becomes known to us as thought, for instance, or as mental images, but activity of the mental consciousness. Does this thought have any substantial characteristics? We ask the same questions. Does it have a color? Does it have a shape? Does it have a location? Where did it come from? Where is it? Where is it going? Origin, location, destination, over and over and over and over again in Mahamudra. And that, so basically we just ask those questions. What we're looking for, is basically we start off with the, I guess you could say the axiom would be, if this is a substantial thing, If the mind exists as a substantial thing, and it seems so often, you know, when our mind is troublesome to us, when it's a problem for us, when it seems like our mind is just totally out of control, and it's not doing what we would like, and it is, you know, has its own program, it seems like the mind must be a substantial thing. So, is it a substantial thing? So it without examining it, it just seems that way. In the same way that the tree across the street, just when I just look at it, it seems to be out there. But when I examine it, I realize, there is no out there that is separate from the space of the mind. So in the same way, then, the mind can seem very substantial until we begin to examine it. So we examine with those same questions. And then if you when you're observing it closely, because you have developed shamatha, you know, so you're really able to focus like a laser now, and while you're observing it, if you don't find any substantial characteristics as you're observing it, you have discovered the nature of mind, or the mind in movement, or the mind in occurrence, or thought, the nature of the thought, is that it is empty of substantial characteristics. Simple enough, right? So the ninth Karmapa begins this section of the text by looking at three particular types of thoughts. Call them genres of thought. So the second of these three are intense thoughts of joy and misery. So both of these are really, grieving, very intense thoughts. So looking at those, and then the third category of thought that he examines to find out whether that is substantial as well is mental afflictions. So we just went through that. So, basically you observe these intense thoughts and mental afflictions and then see whether these are substantial or not. But the first category is the one that I would like to focus on now, because this one is closer, I still am entranced by appearances. And so this one, and that approach of Mahamudra. And so this one is kind of similar to, or close to that. So this first type of thought is looking at the activity of mental consciousness in producing the conceptual image of sensory objects. So this is the one we have looked at, with our using, first of all, the basic object of shamatha, a visual image. So we were beginning to really prepare ourselves for this. In the scene, let there be only the scene. And then you notice that, there's basically, it's the conceptual mind that I'm engaging with when I'm looking at sensory objects. And so this is what we're going to be examining now. These thoughts, and then we'll look at the mind in movement in general and see whether that is different from the mind in stillness. And so he begins this by just inviting us to, and do this right now. Is there anybody here who doesn't have a car? Oh, good for you. Do you have a bike? Think of your house then. You have a house? Yogi who sleeps under a tree at the end of the day wherever they find themselves. So just bring to mind now a familiar object. So let's just say your car or your house. And visualize it. Try to visualize the details of this. And so what are the possibilities of this image now, of the car? Has your car entered your mind? Has the substantial car, right? Yeah, it's funny, right? But, without examining it, we kind of assume, that what happens is when we're meditating, when we become distracted, a mental image might arise, but almost instantly we go off with the referent of the thought. So for instance, your mother, if your mother comes to mind, you aren't seeing it as a mental image. that, oh, the mental image of my mother arose. But phew, suddenly you're gone and you are with your mother. So what's happened? Has your mind gone to your mother? In this instance, has the car entered your mind? The substantial car entered your mind? Well, come on. Has your mind turned into the car? Or has the car become your mind? You know, it can seem like that in our unexamined experience, because we lose the knowing that this is just an image arising in the mind. Or has your mind just traveled to where the car is, you know, and you're actually just viewing the car, you know, just whoosh. So when we are shanghaied by the referent, you know, when our mind goes to the what the image refers to, you know, and then kind of get totally absorbed with the real thing, and we just go kind of mindlessly wandering with the substantial thing. Basically, that's how our experience is being treated. We become unconscious of the fact that these are mental images arising as movements of the mind. And so, you know, we should become amused with our experience when we do that, because this is how ridiculous our experience has become. You know, the car has become the mind, etc. So those are fairly, you know, so those are good images to start with, because they're ones that, you know, maybe we're attached to our cars, etc., in our house. But how about your body? Bring to mind now an image of your body. So how does the body exist? Have you ever known your body as anything other than an image in your own mind? We normally think of not only the body and the mind as being different, but as being polar opposites of substance, right? Like the body, that's substantial material, that's matter. The mind, well, that's something else. Insubstantial, you know, but the body. So when you're visualizing the body, has the substantial body entered the mind, etc.? You know, these, what about the body of the other that you crave? So if you do this simple analysis, what happens to the craving if what you're craving exists only in your own mind, and that there is no other, the body that you see out there is just a mental projection, and you're grasping to that? So according to, as I have mentioned before, according to theories of cognition in Buddhist psychology, the sixth primary consciousness, mental consciousness, whose specialty is conceptuality, does not actually directly experience any of the objects of the senses. So it gets a little technical here, and I'd like to actually hear more about this. So the sixth mental consciousness simply knows mental sensory appearance, and then turns it into an abstraction, so a conceptualization, which is vague. So that's one of the things to really notice about the generalized abstraction, is that it is generalized and that it's vague, and that the actual sensory input would be something really different. But what that is, actually, what the world actually is out there, independent of my mind knowing it, is impossible to say. Right? What is the nature of the world when nobody is looking at it and nobody is observing it? The God's eye view, which was the goal of the first 400 years of physics or so. So what is the God's eye view of the world? As Heisenberg said, let us not attribute existence to that which is unknowable in principle. Right? So it's empty. What is the nature of the world independent of any mind? Who could say? You know, how does the physical world, the green out there seems so real, it's part of the tree. Any idiot would tell you that. So how does that appear to a bat who has different sense apparatus, navigating the world with echolocation? Or how about a pit viper, a rattlesnake, who navigates the world by way largely of infrared? You know, how does the world look inherently to them? So do these, particular, the spectrum of visible light, does that mean anything to them? How about, the world of sensory stimulation for a dog? And all of us, just have different capacities of, how about a blind person, somebody who's deaf? The world is really, really different. What is the true nature of the world? Independent of a perceiver. Is there? Does it make sense? So here's what, again, Yangtang Rinpoche has to say about this role of the mental consciousness, the sixth consciousness, projecting its conceptual generalized abstraction onto sense impressions. He says, the first moment of perceptual awareness is usually okay. For example, when looking at a tree, that very first moment of awareness is okay. It doesn't make any mistake. But mistakes always happen from the second moment of awareness. So it's important not to let those mistakes continue. The first moment is like a mute who cannot speak but can see everything. So you're not mentally talking back to reality. You're just experiencing it. The second moment involving conceptualization is like somebody who is blind but who can talk very well. If you let the conceptual mind continue, it leads to the distractions, dualistic grasping, and delusion. And so when we are examining of the world of experience, and we talk about the term all phenomena. All phenomena refers to appearances, to consciousness, rather than to some presumed independent reality, independent of consciousness. So that's very important to recognize when we're analyzing the nature of all phenomena. These are all phenomena as they appear to consciousness, because it makes no sense to talk about all phenomena independent of consciousness and then try to understand the nature of something that just doesn't exist. And then recognize that all the immediate contents of both our sensory and mental experience. So this is curious and important. All the immediate contents of both the sensory and mental experience are non-physical. Is the green of the tree physical? Is the green of the tree physical? It sure seems like it. That's how I define tree. Tree is green. It has brown bark and etc. Has all these qualities. So it seems like the green is physical. So what is physical? Is the green in a wavelength of light? You know, is there a green photon? Ed? No. The physicist. Is there a green photon? No. So how about a green receptor in the retina? Is there a green receptor in the retina? Is there a green, the experience of green, is it in a neurotransmitter or, you know, neurochemicals? You know, where does the green occur? Is the color green, can the color green be found? And again, talking about the experience of the color green, can the experience of the color green be found in the brain? Where is it? All of those things, all of those physical things, we're talking about a sensory experience. I look out and I see, revealed by visual consciousness, I think, the color green. But it's non-physical. How interesting. So when we recognize the emptiness of these visual images, this in no way contradicts the vivid presence of the image in your mind, the reality. So this doesn't mean that there is no reality. So first of all, it doesn't mean that there is nothing, no physical world, that there is no world of matter or something like that. But just that it basically, how could we ever know it truly? What is there independent of observation? How would that possibly be possible? How could it be? So all that we know are appearances to consciousness, but that emptiness doesn't negate the reality of the appearance in the mind. And so now we have not become nihilists, you know, in saying that there's no importance in anything because nothing exists anyway, because the truth is right there in our own experience. So that is true. The vividness, the vivid presence of the image. So one way of saying that would be the emptiness does not negate the luminosity. So that's why both of these are so vitally important and non-dual, is that they both are just different natures of the same thing. And then when we do this meditation, then the ninth Karmapa will propose some questions for us about what we are observing. And then there are, as I've mentioned before, and the texts have pointed out, there are two very different ways in which we can respond to these questions. So the first is by thinking the right answer to the question and then congratulating yourself that you knew the right answer. But again, that is just going to basically enhance the screen or the obscuration that is preventing you from transformative experience. So The key is just to use these questions to look at your experience without preconception, without knowing what you're going to find, or without wishing that you find something in particular, but just what are you experiencing? What are you observing? And let that be sufficient. And so you have to go through this process. You know, some of the questions might just seem so simplistic, but they're really profound if you just use them as a basis for observation. And you have to go through the process. There's no other way, Mahamudra says. No shortcut. You have to go through the process of direct observation and letting that be the proof to you of what you are experiencing. And so you have to basically then, the realizations are all just the product of the accumulation of experience. As you do this meditation over and over and over again, you just are accumulating experience, and then that leads to changes. And then as Khandra Rinpoche said, as her father, Great Tulku, told her, said, the only way to do that is by wearing out cushions. So when we come back after a 9-minute break, we'll start at 10:15, we will begin to put a dent in the cushion.